BG, settle down, BG. I've paid your bills for decades now, and I'm happy to continue. No need to be embarrassed. I'll never tell anyone that Bill Gates gets his money from me. All right, now, we were previously talking, getting back into the dynamics of things. We were talking about the ideology of communism, who created it, Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, all this kind of stuff. We could talk about why it came up because of the Industrial Revolution. We also saw that it did not catch on. Very few people. Some people were communists, but that's the tiny minority. However, this variation on it, which is socialism, came up, and originally the only difference between socialism and communism was how it was coming to power. That was initially the only difference. But when it did come to power, as I said, very effective, LaSalle's ideas, everything like that, and they tried to institute it, they found out, hey, this does not work. We can't just redistribute everything and try and make everything equal. So they scaled it back. And what it became is like an intermediate stage between capitalism and communism. And that's what it is to this day. Now, this socialism, again, even though it's now in between communism and capitalism, I think I mentioned to you people can get wealthy under socialism, there is private property, things like that. Originally, it was virtually the same as communism. And this was meant to spread. This communist ideology was meant to spread all over the world. It's inevitable that it was going to come to America, guaranteed. Now, I've told you that it took on all of Europe and became dominant in all of Europe very quickly. Well, it's only a matter of time before it comes to the United States. And it did. So why is it that it never took root here like it did in Europe? Even to this day, Europe is definitely substantially to the left, more towards socialism and everything than America. So why didn't it take root in America? Well, two reasons. Firstly, yes, the Industrial Revolution was pretty bad here, just as it was really bad in Europe. But here in America, you had a much lower cost of living. It was much cheaper to live here in America. The cost of land, very cheap. Very cheap. If you want land to build a home and live, everything like that, that's very cheap. The material from which to build that home, what were homes built from at that time? Wood. We had a massive, massive amount of timber, and we still do in this country. So that was dirt cheap. On this abundant land we have, which is, by the way, well watered and regularly watered, it's not like it floods regularly, it floods at odd times and everything like that, we can grow food, all kinds of food, very cheaply. So all the necessities of life are fairly cheap, so things, in fact, are not nearly as bad here in America as they are in Europe. There's another reason. The other reason socialism never took hold is Theodore Roosevelt, whom most or all of you have heard of. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason he's so much more famous than so many other presidents. But what is going on? Who's this guy? Well, he is from a very old family, the Roosevelts. With Roosevelt, that means Field of Roses. It's a Dutch name. And the Dutch have been here for a very long time. And he is from an established, wealthy patrician family. Remember we talked about that term? So well-established in New York City. That's fine. Now, when he was born, he had all kinds of health problems, like asthma and whatnot. And because his father was wealthy, he was able to get the best medical care and everything like that. And when Roosevelt was a baby, and he would have these asthma attacks at night, his father would pick him up and walk him around. This is 3 a.m., 4 a.m., whatever it is, up and down their brownstone in New York City, just until he calmed down And then he'd put the baby back, put Theodore back in his crib. Now, Theodore got older, and then he was too old. He was no longer a baby, but he would still, as a child, have these asthmatic attacks. So what would his father do? He would summon the coachman to bring the coach around, and Theodore's father would take him around the city again in the middle of the night just to calm him down and settle him down. Now, this was a particular time in American history, but also world history, where this theme, the wealthy deserve to be wealthy and the poor deserve to be poor. They're poor because they're lazy or dishonest or have weak character or whatever it is, but it's their own fault. Many of you have heard of Charles Darwin. Okay, Darwin, survival of the fittest. Survival of the fittest. Now, I'd love to talk a little bit more about Darwin, but we'll leave that. I mean, again, he didn't say, firstly, this is a myth. Even among educated people don't realize this. Darwin did not come up with the theory of evolution. That was around before him. What Darwin did was come up with an explanation for how evolution worked. So this theory had been around a long time, but no one could explain what it was that made people change, made people or animals or whatever it was transform. Darwin came up with what it was, and it's natural selection, survival of the fittest. And there was this example of these moths in England, and these light-colored moths on the tree, matching the tree bark. The birds had a hard time seeing them, but they could easily see the dark-colored moths. So the birds would eat the dark-colored moths because they could easily see them. After this Industrial Revolution, started pumping all kinds of soot and dirt into the air. And that, of course, made the trees much darker. Well, that made the light-colored moths very conspicuous, and they started getting eaten. And the dark-colored moths were much more camouflaged. And so they did not get eaten, and they started to multiply more and more and more. And so whereas before there were mostly light-colored moths, after there were dark-colored moths dominant and very few light-colored moths. And that would be natural selection. That's what forced evolution, and Charles Darwin came up with that. Now, that was actually that moth thing with the soot in the air and everything is Darwin's most famous example. But also the reason I thought up that example, it came to mind right now, is because now with the quarantine, with the coronavirus and everything like that, in many parts of the world, people are really surprised when they look out their window and they see how bright the sunshine is and everything like that. People are really, really surprised in many parts of the world. In just a few days, the pollution went away remarkably quickly, and people who had lived their whole lives, and I'm specifically thinking of India, but it's a number of different places, because the businesses weren't running, factories were shut down, everything like that, the difference was gigantic, gigantic. But anyway, and by the way, that applies just as much to viruses and things like that. Theory of natural selection and whatnot. Maybe if we have time, I'll go into that. But anyway, you have Darwin came up with these ideas, but he did not come up with this next thing, social Darwinism. He did not ever come up with that or endorse that idea. Other people took Darwin's ideas of survival of the fittest, and that's another thing. The fittest is not always the strongest. Usually it's not. Usually it's the one that's most adaptable. These things are not only relevant. Okay, they're important for educated people to know. I know it's a struggle for you guys to be doing college and everything like that, and you should expect a really good value, really good return on that investment of your time, money, and effort. But it's not just that these are important things for educated people to know, it's that they apply to absolutely everything. You look at the business world, you look at every possible thing, you'll see this, survival of the fittest, and how that applies. But here, Social Darwinism is really something else. Social Darwinism is specifically that people are successful because they did the right things, and that's why they're successful. That's why they're physically fit. That's why they're rich. That's why everything like that. And people are poor because they just have bad character, as I said. They deserve to be poor. They're beyond help, everything like that. And this was the prevailing attitude of the time, at least amongst the wealthy. And Roosevelt's family was quite wealthy, but his father, again, taking him around in that coach and everything like that, he was different. He was very unusual. As he was taking his son around in the middle of the night, he would point to these homeless people sleeping under a newspaper or whatever it is and say, "You see that man right there? We're no better than he is. We were just luckier. We had more opportunity. We had this, we had that." And Roosevelt conveyed this idea. It's a French term, noblesse oblige. It's spelled some, I mean, I'm really going to misspell this, but it's something like N-O-B-L-I-S and another word, O-B-L-I-J-E, but I'm sure that's badly misspelled. But it's noblesse oblige, this obligation of the nobility. It is basically that people who have a certain responsibility to help the people who don't. Noblesse oblige. It's a common term used today as well amongst the wealthy and things like that. And firstly, so you have this Roosevelt's father being very different and raising his son differently. Secondly, you have Theodore Roosevelt, who, even though he can't empathize with these poor and everything because of money, he can empathize with them. He can understand how they feel and share in their feelings because he was weak in a different way. He was powerless in a different way because of physical health. So he would always remember what it was. And those views, those perspectives would influence everything he did in politics, in his life. When he got still older, his father was told by the doctor, physical activity will help his condition, physical exercise and things like that. So his father turns the brownstone into a gym, or puts a gym in there with weights and everything like that. Theodore Roosevelt eventually becomes the most physically fit president, probably, that we have ever had, to this very day. And he lives an extremely active life. And you can certainly understand when he's a weak boy, unable to play outside, everything like that. When he does build up his strength and stamina, he kind of makes up for lost time. And he's big. He's very much into helping people and social activism and things like that. When he becomes police commissioner of New York City, he would actually ride around the streets at night, in the middle of the night, on a bicycle with a billy club, looking for criminals to beat up. And if you've seen any of the that Batman trilogy with Christian Bale, which is quite good, all three movies are really good, the director, I've seen him in an interview saying he based the Batman character in those three movies on Theodore Roosevelt. One really big example when Roosevelt became president. I mean, we could talk about Roosevelt for at least the full class. I mean, he was very, very famous. There are multi-volume books written about his life, everything like that. But one famous example, coal miners went on strike. Now, they didn't strike in the summer. They struck in the winter. Why would that be when winter was approaching, that is to say? Why would that be, if they want their strike to have meaning for and influence the owners, why would that be a really good time to strike? Because during the winter, people really need that coal to stay warm, everything like that. So this is a serious situation. The mine owners said to President Roosevelt, "Oh, you see they're striking. We want you to send in the army and break up the strike." This is what would have always been done in the past. Always, this is what would have been done. They don't know Theodore Roosevelt is very different. Roosevelt says, I want you to meet with these miners, come up with some mutually beneficial solution, a compromise with them. The owner says, no, we aren't going to do that, and you can't make us. This is a free country, and we'll do whatever we want with our business. Roosevelt says, I'll tell you what, if you don't meet with them and arrange for some sort of equitable compromise, I will send the army in, but not to break up the strike. I'm going to nationalize those mines and have the army work them on behalf of the government. Now, that's a very serious thing. To nationalize a business means the government is taking it over and will own it. But this is arguably an emergency situation. The people need coal, and so his threat had value. Theodore Roosevelt is very famous for this saying, speak softly and carry a big stick. Speak softly and carry a big stick. And here he used it with this threat. If you don't do this, and while he was at it, he also said this to big business. You've got these people who work for you all their lives and everything like that, but they get injured. Let's say they break their arms, something like that. They can't work anymore until they're healed. So for that month or so, they're not collecting a paycheck. They're basically going to lose their home. They won't be able to pay their rent. Their lives are ruined. What I want you to do is take a little bit out of each person's paycheck, put it in a fund, and you, the owners, are going to match that amount and put the same into that same fund. And when a person gets injured, they will be able to draw money from that fund so that they won't be completely destitute and their family will be ruined and they will be ruined. And this is how we got workmen's compensation here in America. Roosevelt said, while you're at it, I want you to take a little bit more out of their paychecks, put it into a different fund, and again, you match that money equally into that fund. Because these people, they work for you their entire lives, 20 years, 30 years, they're working for you. So they're working for you, and then they have nothing. They can't work anymore, and then they're spending their elderly years, again, homeless, destitute. What can they do? When they have this money in the fund, if they've worked for you for however long that is, 20 years, whatever, 25 years, then they get to retire. They can draw money from this account for the rest of their lives so that they can live their golden years, however many they may be, without being completely impoverished and everything like that. And yes, this is how we got pensions in America. By the way, pensions, you know, there's a lot more we could go into any of these topics, but this one in particular, you have, especially here in Miami, things like that, the pensions had gotten really, really out of control with first responders, which are great. You know, they're doing their job and everything like that. Firstly, employees of Dade County, they get to retire after 30 years and they get a pension. And that's based, usually that's based on what's called the drop program, which is the highest 5 years of their earnings, which are usually their last 5 years, are averaged. And then you get 50% of that, 50, for life. Now, what would happen in areas like, especially the police, especially nothing to my knowledge equals what the police get. They are in a certain high risk category along with firefighters, paramedics. I don't know what's wrong with me. Yes, I'm tired. But they fall into a special category where they can retire after 20 years, not 30. So say somebody becomes a, but again, nobody has benefits like the police. They even have a Me Too clause. My info is a little out of date, but for example, anything firefighters got in their contract, police would automatically have to get it. So, fine, somebody becomes a cop at, let's say, 20. They could become a cop younger than that, but let's say 20. They could retire after 20 years, which is when they're 40. And then one thing that the police really, really make their money on is overtime. And so in their last 5 years, which is usually when you make your most money because it goes up the longer you've worked there, they usually get a huge amount of overtime given to them. So they wind up making double their salary. So they're making over $100,000 a year by in those last 5 years. And so when they were well over $100,000, and when they retire, they're getting 50% of that inflated salary, which winds up being their normal salary. So actually, you know, police can make like, some of them make over $200,000 a year. But let's say, you know, they retire, they're getting, let's say, $80,000 a year, or let's say $70,000 a year for life. And now the thing is, here's the thing I wanted to bring up. Maybe we don't have time for this, but I think it warrants bringing up. One of the biggest reasons that pensions have gone away, you know, very few jobs, unless you work for the government, come with a pension these days. Partly it's because people are living so much longer. It was meant to be you work one or two, I mean, you retire and then you live a few years longer, maybe 3, 4, 5 years, and then you die. Now, even if you retire at, say, 55, let's say 55, people are living until 80 or something like that. You see these cops, if they retire at 40, so they've been working 20 years, now really they should work the full 30 to get their full benefits. But let's say they retire at 40. Let's even say they retire at 50. So they work 30 years, and then they're going to live probably another 30 years getting basically their full salary, because it's 50% of their highest salary, but that highest salary was really double what it should have been because of all that overtime. So basically, you're paying people for 30 years to work, and then you're paying them for another 30 to not work. And this was not a sustainable format. But originally, this was a very good idea, a very powerful idea. Now you get the pensions. And incidentally, you know, this negotiation with the coal mine owner specifically was kind of exhausting. And then he went off on another one of his hunts. He loved hunting and camping and the great outdoors and everything like that. And the governor of Mississippi had invited him down for a bear hunt. Okay, come on down for a bear hunt. So he came with his entourage and everything like that. His friends, that is to say, his journalists. This is the president of the United States, so they wanted to see what's going on. Now, Roosevelt, first day of the hunt, doesn't see any bears. Journalists write all this up. Second day of the hunt, no bear. This is getting embarrassing. You've invited the president of the United States to a bear hunt, and there aren't any bears. This is getting really, really embarrassing. Now, his people find this bear, this black bear, in the forest, and they tie it to a tree. And you got this injured bear that they subdued and everything like that, and they go get the president. Ah, here you go. Now you can get a trophy, and you won't be going home empty-handed. And some of you may know this story. Theodore Roosevelt says, no, you know, this is unsportsmanlike. I'm not going to shoot a tied-up bear, a bear tied to a tree. What kind of hunt is that? What kind of sport is that? And so he refuses to kill the bear. Now, the journalists write about this. All the journalists say, oh, look at this. And in fact, this one cartoonist draws this very famous cartoon with Teddy Roosevelt sparing the life of this baby bear. It wasn't a baby cub. It was a big bear. And somebody else killed it, by the way, just so you know. But Theodore Roosevelt didn't. He spared it. And this became this big thing all across the country. And this married couple who owned a candy shop in Brooklyn that also sold toys, the wife actually made a stuffed bear out of velvet and everything like that and called it Teddy's Bear. you know, very moved by this incident and everything like that. And the husband, he saw, both of them, frankly, saw how many people wanted to buy these bears. A huge, amazingly large amount. And the husband still said, well, you know what, this is the president and everything like that. He mailed Theodore Roosevelt one of these bears and asked his permission. May we use that to name these bears? And he wrote back and said, yes, you may. They became known as Teddy's Bears, and they became known as Teddy Bears. That's how that name came about, because of Roosevelt's generosity and kindness and what have you. I wonder if any of you students are going to recognize my kindness and generosity and name a bear after me, like Winnie the Pooh, but Flinny the Pooh. Get on that. Get on that. Now, Roosevelt was a tough guy. Very tough, very rough and rugged. This one time he was going to give a speech. Very famous incident. And he's going there, and an anarchist runs up and shoots him in the chest. Now people tackle this guy and everything like that. They take the gun away from him, and Theodore Roosevelt has been shot in the chest. And people are saying, Mr. President, we need to rush you to the hospital, everything like that. Theodore Roosevelt says, no, I have a speech to give. And he goes, he gives an abbreviated version of his speech, and he even holds it up, and he says, well, you know, if you'll excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, I've been shot in the chest. And he holds up his speech with a bullet hole in it. And that's the reason why he wasn't more severely injured. You see, he's carrying the speech, and it's folded in two, so it's doubled. And where is he going to keep it? In his breast pocket. That slowed the bullet. But what slowed it even more is he wore glasses at that time, and they're called glasses because they were originally made out of glass, and you had the lenses were. And the frames were pretty delicate as well. And so you had to keep them in a very hard case. And where are you going to keep that? In your breast pocket. And that also slowed the bullet. And that's why he wasn't killed instantly. So he's shot in the chest, everything like that. Take him to the doctor. The doctor is on record saying, I have never had to cut through so much muscle in my entire career. Not just for a politician or a president. No one he had ever worked on, that surgeon, had ever had that much muscle on them. That's how rough and tough Theodore Roosevelt was. He would challenge visiting dignitaries to the office from Russia and everything like that to boxing matches right there in the Oval Office. He would move the furniture around and say, step right up, son, I'll put you through the meat grinder. I mean, we don't know what he said. I'm just assuming that's what he said. But, you know, Roosevelt, and he was good, too. When he was at Harvard, he was a boxing champ. But he's a college boxer, college boxing champ at Harvard. He would challenge his aides as well, his assistants and everything like that. And one of them, I believe he was a colonel. You know, and he was a real boxing champ. He was an actual boxing champ. Okay, let's play. You know, we'll do this with the president. And guys, if you've ever been doing this with your friends, you're hitting each other and everything like that, one guy, you're playing around, but one guy hits the other guy a little too hard. Now, knowing what you know about guys, does the guy who got hit say, oh, that was a little too rough. We're both gentlemen now. Let's step back. Let's cool things off. No. The guy who gets hit a little too hard hits the other guy even harder to show, I'm not a wimp. I'll teach you a lesson. And of course, now this other guy hits him even harder. And very quickly, you are in an all-out fight. Pretty soon, you're not play fighting. You're fighting. And that's what happened with Roosevelt and this young... Oh, he wasn't a colonel, I remember now. He was an artillery captain. I remember that. You know, you might find it interesting in my World Civ 1 class, I explain why the military ranks are what they are, how each rank got to be what it is, and why the rank of captain is so high in the Navy, but not really very high in the other services. Anyway, so they're fighting. You know, it becomes a real fight. And again, Roosevelt's good, but this guy's basically an expert boxer. And he clips Roosevelt at just the wrong time, and Roosevelt goes down, and he hits his head on the table as he's falling, and he pops his eyeball out. It eventually is a detached retina and leaves Roosevelt blind in one eye, eventually. But this army captain must have been horrified. They rushed Roosevelt to a doctor and everything like that, and the doctors did everything they could, but he permanently had eye problems in that eye, the left eye, I believe, and that's one of the reasons why he needed the glasses. It reminds me of this guy I used to train with in Wing Chun, Francisco. When he was in high school, he was dating this cheerleader who was the ex-girlfriend of one of the basketball players. And Francisco was also the mascot. So Francisco, before one of the basketball games, he was doing his mascot thing, and the ex-boyfriend, Gary, and his teammates come out, and Gary and the teammates all start hitting Francisco. And the crowd all thinks it's part of the show, but they're actually trying to beat up this guy. And after the game, Francisco actually pressed charges for assault, and Gary lost his scholarship to a top 10 school. Now, time goes by after high school and everything like that, and Francisco one day is in the parking lot of a supermarket or something like that, and then he sees Gary in a car leering at him menacingly, and Gary guns the car at Francisco. Francisco jumps out of the way but still gets clipped by it, and he's lying on the floor, and he sees Gary get out of the car coming toward him holding a tire iron. Francisco gets up dazed. Now, he was good at martial arts, not as good as me, of course, but he does, you know, he's dazed, he's injured and everything like that, and he does a four-finger eye jab at Gary, and he does it so hard he pops Gary's eyeball out of his head. And this is what the doctors say. Had he just left it alone, Gary, not done anything, it would have been fine. But Gary instinctively, I'm sure, tries to push the eyeball back in instantly. And what he does is he mashes his own eyeball. So Gary was permanently blind in that eye for life. And of course, he went to prison for trying to murder my friend. And of course, I would always send Francisco these prank emails from Gary. They're releasing me next week. I'm going to kill you for pressing charges against me. Anyway.
This thing seems to have not been recording for the last few minutes, at least. I'm going to stop it and start it again. Actually, you guys should have all finished your midterm by now. I'm going to go check on that, and then I'll probably come back to this.